Welcome to the Eldritch Estate, an establishment dedicated to the bizarre, the dark, and all that is otherworldly. We invite our guests to come and stay a while, to enjoy the haunted hallways, the shrieks of terror and delight, to forget time in our enchantingly disturbing abode. Whether it's for an overnighter or a week-long stay, our hostesses will see to it that you are shocked, horrified, and left morbidly curious about the goings-on here at the estate. Will you take a trip with us? We can't wait for you to see what's in store.
Hello, and welcome back to the Eldritch Estate. I'm Dusty.
And I'm Katie.
Welcome to the Eldritch Estate, where the rules are made up and the points don't matter.
And Dusty doesn't fuck up the funny intro joke.
Alright, this is part two of our H.H. Holmes episode, the season two finale. Last time we did a part two, we didn't know it was going to be a part two, so I didn't get to give you guys an intro. So here's the intro for part two, and let's go.
Surprise! Right. It's not a surprise, though. Because we told you about it in part
this
one.
This one's not a surprise.
I know.
But
I wanted to feel
the
like
the Branch Davidians, I was like, damn, this bitch getting long. And then we just, like, kept going. And then when I was editing, I was like, I gotta cut it, man.
Chip chop. Chip, chip chop.
And then the recording, like, software that we use was not letting me record a new intro on top of the old audio. And I was like, you bitch! Like, let me just... And then one of our listeners was like, you guys didn't do the intro in that one. And I was like, damn it! I'm so sorry!
They caught it! They caught us!
So here's your intro for part two, season two finale.
We love you guys.
You're welcome. Alright. In another instance, Holmes had built what he described as a large kiln in the basement of the building.
Okay, I joked about having a 10th floor down freezer, and it's actually an oven.
It was about 3 feet wide, 8 feet deep, and 3 feet high.
Body-sized.
He had hooked up the gas lines to it and insulated it with another box of a slightly smaller size made of strong brick that should have held the flames in. Despite this, when he tested it, he couldn't get the temperature to the degree that he wanted. He called a furnace specialist, giving his name as the owner of Warner Glass Company. This is another fake-ass name. He said, like, I'm the owner of Warner Glass Company. But really, all of these people are him. So the technician came down and had a look at it and decided he knew what the problem was. It was odd, but a totally new device, and he understood the purpose of it. He was like, oh, like, you're not doing it in the typical way, but like, yeah, this could be made to make glass. Like, I see what you're trying to do here, basically. He got some men down to work on it, and they were able to make a few adjustments and get the internal temperature of the kiln to 3,000 degrees or so.
Holy shitballs, that's hot.
Holmes was pleased with this and sent the man away. It wasn't until later that the technician realized that the shape of the kiln was not nearly big enough or wide enough for the large panes of glass that were being made at this time. No, in fact, the shape of the kiln was a lot more like those used in crematoriums to process dead bodies.
Yeah, like I said, a body stove.
Yeah, he didn't think of it at the time. It wasn't until later.
Are you sure?
Meanwhile, business in the drugstore was booming, although a woman in the neighborhood noticed that they had a hard time finding clerks to run the counters.
I wonder why.
Oh, it wasn't for lack of trying. They had several gorgeous young women who tended to the store at any given time, but they had a habit of up and leaving without a trace.
Weird.
Sometimes they would even leave their belongings in the apartments on the second floor.
Bizarre.
She thought it was strange, but simply chalked it up to young folks being restless and irresponsible.
Clearly.
What the fuck?
What the fuck?
Yeah. Have I mentioned we're not even to the murder yet? Like, there's several murders being hinted at here, but, like, we haven't even really begun.
Okay. I hate it.
Also in 1891, I'm gonna fuck this name up, I'm sorry. A man by the name of Isilius Connor, who preferred to be called Ned, which, like, thank you, Ned, because that's a lot easier to pronounce, moved to Chicago with his family. The Connors consisted of Ned and his wife Julia and their daughter Pearl and Julia's sister Gertie. Both women were told to be stunning. Julia was tall and curvaceous, and Gertie was slim and dark. In fact, many descriptions of Julia describe her as, like, very tall for a woman, and, like, obscenely curvaceous. Like, she was a fucking Jessica Rabbit. Ned took up a job at the jewelry counter in Holmes's drugstore, and Holmes became very familiar with them all very quickly.
Of course.
Now, as was his usual way, he wooed the women with his manner, and we see this in every fucking situation. He spoke to them with words dripping in honey, offering small touches to their shoulder or the small of their back or their waist, and these kinds of touches were seen as inappropriate at the time, but it mainly thrilled the women. They were like, oh my god, he's touching me and he shouldn't be, but like, oh, it's like, it's
racy.
It's, yeah, it was like getting them like hot under the collar. He would smile and he would set his piercing blue eyes on them. They all talk about how his blue eyes would just go right through you and that they were, like, entranced by him. Like, every single account of him talks about this.
Why does he sound as charming as a cult leader?
Probably could have been a cult leader.
Maybe he was.
Ned said he felt as if he was a background character in his own life. Indeed, whenever Holmes left the area, his wife and sister-in-law were downright cold to him, snappish even. So, like, they were so infatuated with him that they, like, start treating Ned like shit, and then when Holmes leaves and Ned's like, oh, finally I can, like, talk to them again, they would be, like, bitches to him. One day...
He ain't even as cute.
I know, and poor Ned. One day, Holmes asked Ned for a favor. He took him down to a big vault, and both men went inside.
No.
Holmes instructed him to close the door, and then listen for shouting to see how soundproof the vault was. So Ned steps out of the vault, and Holmes remains inside, and he closes the door and puts his ear up to the crack and listens. He claimed he could only hear the faintest noise. Then, Holmes asked Ned to step inside. He said now he wanted to hear how little of the sound escaped from the outside. He shut Ned.
What is the purpose of this activity? Why does this room need to be soundproofed? Wait a minute. I have questions before you lock me into a death cellar. Thank you.
Yeah, PSA, don't let somebody lock you into a vault. Number one. And two, if they are asking you to step into a vault for any reason, ask some fucking clarifying questions.
Well, and, like, the selling point on getting me to go into a death cellar is not, like, listen, you can't hear my screams.
Exactly.
What are you trying to sell me on here, bruh?
So then he shut Ned in the vault and waited. And, you know, Ned's shouting and everything. And he let him out, but the whole affair really spooked Ned. Because he was thinking the same thing. Like, why the fuck did you just demonstrate to me that you have a soundproof vault? And why the fuck do you have a soundproof vault?
Especially when my wife is infatuated with you.
Mm-hmm.
Yucky.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he said, like, it never really sat right with him. The whole thing just fucking freaked him out. Now, several months later, Gertie came storming into the jewelry counter distraught. She was in tears and blustered at Ned that she hated Chicago, she should never have come here, and she wanted to leave immediately. Now, remember, the women aren't treating Ned very nicely at this time, so he tries to question her and, like, figure out what was the matter, but she wouldn't say anything. She just became more and more upset at his interrogation. And he eventually shrugs it off because, like, he can tell that she's upset, but she's not talking to him and he's not really making any headway.
She got broken up with.
Yeah.
She not... They ain't making no more screams in that soundproof room.
Mm-hmm. Well, not them kind of screams anyway.
Nope. Not anymore. Almost the murder screams. We're almost there. I feel it.
Holmes came in later that day, and Gertie would not look at him. She would not speak to him. She was flushed at the cheeks, and she seemed flustered. Ned didn't notice. Typical. A few days later, she was on a train back to Iowa. A few weeks after that, she had fallen very ill. Before long, she had passed away. Holmes told Ned how sorry he was for his loss, but he said it in a flat, cold manner. Emotionless.
Poisoned.
You're talking about a pharmacist who has an extensive knowledge of drugs.
Poisoned.
Something goes down, she's upset and wants to leave Chicago. She leaves, within a few weeks, dead. Hmm.
she found something she wasn't supposed to find.
Or he gave it to her and was like, take this for whatever fucking ailment he fucking conjured up.
After he broke up with her.
Yeah, and she just like didn't even think about it, just took it because she trusted him as a pharmacist.
And she drank this tea every day that was poison.
Basically. That's allegedly.
Ooh, allegedly.
Now, this sets in motion a whole other series of drama between Ned and his wife, Julia. Their marriage had never been smooth sailing, but with the loss of Gertie and their daughter Pearl's unpredictably moody and sullen behavior, they were really struggling. Pearl's, like, 10 at the time, and I guess she would just suddenly go, like, completely silent and be, like, really upset at them or, like, fly off the handle, which you would expect from a preteen or teenager, but at 10, they were like, what the, and like, they couldn't figure out what to do with her, basically.
Okay.
They fought constantly, and in between, they had bouts of icy silence.
Yeesh.
Ned felt himself falling more and more flat, his confidence waning, especially in the shadow of young, handsome, successful, rich Dr. Holmes. So, I know. Holmes offers Ned a deal. He's willing to sell the pharmacy portion of the retail space to Ned at an extremely reasonable, perhaps too good to be true, cost. Ned currently makes $12 a week. Holmes agrees to up his wages to $18 a week.
Don't worry, you won't have any competition.
He then tells Ned he can sell him the pharmacy at a cost of $6 per week until the pharmacy's paid off.
What a dick!
But like I said, he was a fucking snake.
Okay, but he wasn't like 12,
carry 13, the one.
14.
How do you...
carry the one minus the $6.
So...
you bitch.
He tells him, no need to actually hand over the $6 each week. Holmes would simply deduct it from the new $18 wage. So he would still get $12 per week, but now he would be the owner of a successful, shiny pharmacy.
What an asshole.
And Ned agrees.
Hook, line, and sinker. That is so rude.
Shortly after this, Holmes attempts to sell Ned some life insurance. So, he insists that Ned should get the shop insured, as well as himself, and of course his family, and especially his daughter, Pearl.
He's gonna burn that building up with them inside of it. What the fuck?
Don't you love your child? You should definitely get her life insurance.
There's so many dangerous things in this world. Have you met some of these people walking around on these streets?
These absolute monsters just hiding among us, Ned. You've gotta get the insurance.
In plain sight.
So Ned refuses and refuses and refuses, and Holmes tries and tries and tries.
He's like, I'm gonna need that $6, bruh.
Meanwhile, he and Julia's marriage continues to crumble. He suspects that she's having an affair with Holmes. Fucking no duh, dude.
Wow. Like, really?
What tipped you off?
I'm shocked.
So he gives her an ultimatum. Either the hostility and silent treatment needs to end, or they would have to separate. She replied, quote, separation couldn't come too soon to suit me.
What a spicy bitch.
Damn.
Ouch.
A few months later, they were done. Ned told Holmes he was leaving, and despite Holmes's pleas and smooth talk, Ned left for another jewelry counter not too far away. Once he was out of the picture.
Ended up dead.
Right? Once he was out of the picture, Holmes's relationship with Julia cooled considerably. He just wasn't as interested in her anymore, and Pearl's dark demeanor wasn't helping any. Now, in November of 1891, Julia announced tearfully to Holmes that she was pregnant. Now he had no choice. He had to marry her.
Number three.
You may have noticed that Holmes is racking up wives. Children at that, too. I am going to give a trigger warning here. We are going to be discussing abortion and death. Please skip ahead if you need to.
I would like to skip.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Julia was very convincing, and Holmes couldn't deny that she was right. To be in a relationship like this during the time and be unwed was completely taboo. Not just the relationship, but the child would be socially ruinous. So, they agreed to be wed. But, Holmes argued, a child would just be far too much. They would already be dealing with the marriage and trying to raise Pearl, and with the construction continuing on his building and his upward climbing career, well, it was just all too much.
What an asshole. He's like, I'm really busy with my job, and your daughter's kind of a bitch, so I don't think you should have this baby. What an asshole.
And he did it from, like, a sympathetic point of view. Like, you don't want a baby right now. Like, we're gonna be newlyweds. We're gonna need to find a place for us to live together. Pearl is going through a lot right now since her dad left. Like, you...
Which was his fault? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know. So he, like, again, he smooth-talks his way through fucking everything. Including convincing her that he would perform an abortion.
What the fuck?
After all, according to everyone around him, Holmes was a licensed doctor. Now, again, he did graduate from medical school. All his teachers said he was a piss-poor student, but he did graduate from medical school. He had the tools, the knowledge, the experience. He would simply conduct the abortion, marry Julia, and they would all be a happy little family, so he said.
Okay, if they have to get married because of the baby, and he's gonna abort the baby, he definitely ain't gonna marry you.
Julia doesn't see it. He's that smooth. I know, I know.
They've all drank the Holmes Kool-Aid.
Yes.
Okay.
They decided that the abortion would take place on Christmas Eve.
Why in the actual
I have no fucking clue.
He gave
why
himself...
Why they picked this date.
No, I know why. He gave himself a gift.
Oh my god.
What a piece of shit. Okay.
So Julia would have only been a few weeks pregnant at the time, because she found out she was pregnant in November. So, like, she would not have been very far along.
Mm-mm.
Additionally... They were supposed to be visiting Julia's older sister, not Gertie, different sister, in Iowa for a wedding, like, right around this time. Prior to leaving for the wedding, they were going to spend some time celebrating on Christmas with their neighbors, Mr. and Mrs. Crow, a kindly older couple who lived down the hall. Christmas Eve came, Julia put Pearl to bed, kissing her goodnight and promising her lots of fun and presents the next day. They would see their friends, the Crows, and then they would travel to Iowa to be with family and do the wedding and everything like that. After Pearl had gone to bed, Julia said goodnight and slipped out. No one had any idea that she was supposed to be stepping out that night, where she was going, or why. Like, she'd had several conversations with people throughout the day, and she had not hinted about anything.
Well, I mean, I'm sure it was... I mean, it's still controversial now, but yeah. Extremely scandalous.
It had
then.
To be a complete secret. Right. So, everyone expected Christmas morning and the events of the following day to go off as planned. But Holmes had other plans.
Shocker.
Julia arrived at the murder castle, and Holmes took her to a room on the second floor that he'd prepped for the operation. 1891, ladies and gentlemen. 1891.
Hold, please. What kind of anesthesia existed in 1891?
He chloroforms her.
Okay.
So Holmes got Julia laid down on a white table dressed in linen. He squeezed her hand and took out the chloroform. He poured it into a rag, reassured her, and held it against her nose and mouth. She began to go limp, but just before she lost consciousness, she tried to push his hand away to run, to escape. Now, I guess this is pretty common because your body starts to fight against the chloroform. She beat at his arms, and he just held her tighter, clamping over her with an animalistic force.
Or she changed her fucking mind.
After that, Holmes went down the hall and repeated the process with Pearl.
What the fuck?
He's just gonna get rid of this problem all at once. Christmas morning came and went. The Crows waited for Pearl and Julia, but saw no sign of them. They left for another gathering, they had another Christmas party to go to, but they put a note on the door and a key for the girls to let themselves in. When they returned at 11 p.m., they saw that everything was just as they'd left it, with no signs that the girls had been by. They saw Holmes a while later and asked him where they'd gone. He replied that they'd left early for Iowa to go to the wedding, nothing to be worried about.
Then why didn't you go, and why didn't they say anything, and what a giant piece of shit.
Yeah.
Okay.
This was the last anyone ever saw of Julia or Pearl alive. Julia would make a reappearance in Chicago, though, just not in a way that was recognizable.
Hmm.
Remember Charles Chappell from earlier? One of Holmes's associates?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Holmes had recently learned that he was an articulator. This meant that he had gone through the proper training and possessed the necessary implements to clean a corpse and reduce it to bones, then piece the body back together and articulate it, resulting in a full and accurate skeleton. As we discussed earlier, medical schools were desperate for bodies and had even taken to grave robbing in an effort to instruct the nation's future doctors in medicine and anatomy. Holmes calls Chappell into the murder castle to look at a body which he would like turned into a skeleton. Chappell doesn't bat an eye because he too is a fucking sociopath, I guess.
Your
buddy calls you up and is like, hey, can you turn this body into a skeleton for me? And you're like, sure, bro, no problem.
Not where'd you get it or who is it?
Why
or...
do you have a fucking dead body? Like, number
this
one.
Is just a casual thing
question
to
number one.
In the 1800s?
I don't know. So Chappell comes to take a look at the body, and he mentions that he's kind of, like, interested slash impressed at how the cadaver looks. He's quoted as saying, the body looked like that of a jackrabbit which had been skinned by splitting the skin down the face and rolling it back off the entire body. In some places, considerable of the flesh had been taken off with it. End quote.
I hate it.
Yes.
Like, my tummy hurts. I hate it.
Yes. Holmes offered him $36 to articulate the skeleton, and Chappell accepted. Once he returned the body to Holmes, Holmes promptly sold it to a nearby medical school for several times what he paid.
He made money to kill someone.
Yep. And, like, according to all documents, paperwork, whatever, he did it legally. Nobody is any the wiser. In January of 1892, nearly 2 weeks after Christmas, now remember, he killed Julia and Pearl on Christmas Eve, he rented out their apartment to a new family called the Doyles. They were shocked to find the place fully furnished with the table set and an outfit of girl's clothing draped over the back of the chair, ready to be worn. Holmes sadly explained that the two had left in a real hurry, and apologized for the state of things, but Julia's sister had fallen gravely ill, and they'd simply picked up and left without packing their belongings. As time went on, he changed his story to one of Julia and Pearl fleeing from Ned, and even insinuated that Iowa was a false location to throw him off, and that they'd moved elsewhere to escape him.
What the fuck?
I know!
Like, you fucked his wife, and then you murdered him, and then you're like, oh, and by the way, they were running from him.
Ned is not dead.
No, but fuck Holmes. That's terrible. Like, Holmes how dirty can you do that poor man?
Seriously. Like, poor Ned. Ned's gonna come back, though. Don't you worry.
Good. I hope Ned burns him in the eye with a cigar.
Alright. So... God, I can't even believe the sentence that's about to come out of my mouth.
Okay.
Around May of that year, Holmes met another young woman who caught his eye. Fucking shocker. Shocker, I know. Imagine that. Her name was Emmeline Siegrind. She had moved to Chicago and started working for Holmes as a typist. Now, remember Benjamin Pitezel, another one of Holmes' associates? He was the one who had actually met Emmeline in Dwight, Illinois, while undergoing an alcoholism rehabilitation program led by Dr. Keeley. The treatment involved an injection of some sort, administered 3 times daily, and Emmeline had been working there as a typist, and Pitezel had fallen head over heels for her, calling her a preternatural beauty. He offered her a job as a typist back in Chicago, and he offered her much more than what she was being paid in Dwight, and she graciously accepted. Not long after her arrival, she became involved with Holmes. And that's the other thing that kind of kills me, too, is it's not just that he's preying on these women and, like, getting them, like, to fall in love with him, but it's always fucking...
She's swooping up his homies' girls!
They're always with someone else at the time. And then, like we saw, once the man leaves, he's not interested any longer.
He's once like, it's well, not, like, dirty and wrong.
Mm-hmm. He's like, well, that's no fun. He set to her with his sweet words, his blue stare, his daring touches, and as with so many before her, she fell under his spell. And as with so many others, she too was promised marriage at the hand of Dr. Holmes. She accepted, and he wooed her with the pledge of a honeymoon in Europe. A few months into her employment with Holmes, a Mr. Ned Connor came by, heated, to speak with Holmes.
Good.
Emmeline replied that he wasn't there. Could she take a message? Ned and Emmeline get to talking, specifically about Holmes, and he gives her a word of warning. He tries to convince her that he's not what he seems, and she's better off staying far away from him.
He's over here. Hide your kids, hide your wife.
You gon' fucking die.
Yup.
She doesn't change her mind, but the seed of doubt has been planted. In December of 1892, Emmeline goes to see her friends, the Lawrences, who rented an apartment in Holmes' murder castle. I'm gonna keep calling it the murder castle, by the way.
Because it's a fucking murder castle.
It's a fucking murder castle. She presents Mrs. Lawrence with a gift, a tin plate hand-painted with a forest scene by Emmeline herself. Mrs. Lawrence asks why she didn't just wait and give the gift at Christmas when she could have returned the favor with a gift herself. Emmeline happily replies that she's going back to Indiana for Christmas to see family and just couldn't wait to give them the gift. A few days later, Emmeline is gone. In fact, she had never even said goodbye. And again, as with so many others, she does not return. Mrs. Lawrence goes to Holmes to ask him about it. He flippantly replies that she's gotten married. Right. Right. A few
what?
More. Right? Because, like, everyone knows y'all fucking. You know what I'm saying? And now he's like, oh yeah, she got married.
I don't know, she found some dude and ran away.
I don't know, some dude. Whatever. Like, and he gets away with it for the most part.
You are not creative, bro.
A few more days go by, and Mrs. Lawrence isn't satisfied. Which, like, you go, Mrs. Lawrence.
Word.
You go, Glen Coco.
She's over here like, I don't know, smells fishy.
Mm-hmm. She asks him again. Surely, if she'd been getting married, she would have told the Lawrences they were close friends. She would have made wedding announcements. She would have at least mentioned this man's.
Mm-hmm.
Besides, everyone knew that Holmes and Emmeline were together. Like, it was obvious. So, like, what the fuck? Holmes then proceeds to present a wedding announcement that simply reads, Mr. Robert E. Phelps, Miss Emmeline G. Sigrund, married, Wednesday, December 7th, 1892, Chicago. Lawrence is, of course, dumbstruck. She's never even heard of Robert Phelps, and why didn't she get an announcement? Like, what the fuck, she's saying.
Word.
She continues to hound Holmes about it, and he continues to brush her off. Soon, she begins to suspect him of murdering Emmeline.
Well,
she recalls.
If it quacks like a duck.
Literally. Like, Mrs. Lawrence is on point.
Hell yeah.
She recalls that the day before Emmeline disappeared, Holmes' office was shut and locked, and the only people in and out were Holmes and his associate, Patrick Quinlan. That's the third name I mentioned earlier. They struggled with a very large and very heavy trunk, which appeared quite new, taking it downstairs and outside. An express wagon picked up the trunk and took it away. Now, even though the Lawrences suspected Holmes, they did not go to the police. It was just another young girl from out of town who had gone missing. There were bodies being dumped in the river daily. Young men and women moved to Chicago for work and left within weeks, or were killed, or were mugged, and, like...
Or they just got married.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Down. Yeah. The police at the time were often just regular people who were appointed by government folks with, like, no training or experience to speak of. They'd be like, hey, Jim, you're a responsible guy. I'm making you a police
officer.
You're
the sheriff.
Yeah, and they'd be like, what?
You're the captain now.
They didn't really have any real detectives to solve these crimes, and most of all, no one fucking cared. Like, there was just too much going on. So Emmeline is gone without a trace, and no one would seek to find out what had happened. A few weeks later, a trunk with all of her belongings arrived at her parents' house with no explanation. They assumed she had died while on that honeymoon in Europe with her newlywed husband, Robert Phelps, and that he just couldn't bring himself to write them. There's a few things here that are important to note. Wedding announcements that had been addressed and signed in Emmeline's hand had gone out to select friends and family, so not only Holmes, quote-unquote, but also family had received these, quote-unquote, wedding announcements. It's likely that Holmes either had her fill them out not knowing what they would be used for, or that he forged her writing.
Ooh. I heard something like that in a more recent case that I was listening to a podcast about, where he had them sign blank pieces of paper.
Uh-huh.
book.
They do that a lot in those, like, weird, like, sex slave capture kidnapping type yes. cases.
Was it the toy box?
And they turn it into a... Yeah, toy box Word. Did that. And also the girl who lived in a box, I feel so bad I cannot remember her name right now, but they kept her for, like, 13 years or some
a
shit like that.
A long fucking time.
They did that. They called it the company, and they said, you're gonna sign this contract, and now you work for the company.
Oh, this is the one I'm thinking of. Yeah. And she was, like, kept in a house with this guy's children and shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that she legitimately thought that the company was real, and that if she tried to run away, they would kill her family.
Yep.
That's Sorry, a case that's for another time.
That's the vibe this has given me.
It is the vibe. Robert Phelps was an alias used by Ben Pitizel, and was, in fact, the name he'd been using when he first met Emmeline at the Keeley Institute. On January 2nd, 1893, Holmes hired Chapel to articulate another skeleton. He sent him the body of a young woman in a trunk to be processed.
Ugh.
As before, the skin was flayed and peeled back to the flesh. A few weeks later, LaSalle Medical College received a brand new articulated skeleton. Purchased
Shocker.
From one Dr. Holmes, I'm sure. And last but not least, and this is fucking spooky-ooky, I'm getting chills just thinking about it. The vault door of the soundproof room in the murder castle had a footprint which had been inexplicably etched onto the smooth enamel of the door about 2 feet from the ground. The imprint of a toe, ball, and heel was so well-defined and petite it had to belong to that of a woman. How the imprint got there was a mystery that would not be solved for another 3 years.
Ugh.
Because they tried everything to get this footprint out, and it's like an imprint into the enamel door, which is completely smooth, on the door of this soundproof vault. So what they eventually deduced happened is that he either poured acid on the ground or filled up a part of the area with acid, and that Emmeline must have accidentally stepped in it and then tried to press against the door with her foot, and so the acid on her foot left this imprint of a woman's toe, ball of her foot, and heel in the door that would never go away.
What the fuck?
What the fuck?
What the fuck? Okay.
Okay.
I love your notes. Talk about the acid.
I wasn't sure how to write that notes style, so I was like, I'm gonna just talk about it. I'm not gonna forget that. That's
you can't now.
Burned into my memories. In the early winter months of 1893, Holmes was facing a dilemma. He had his hotel, his lucrative new skeleton creation business.
Clearly.
His trusted associates, and he'd gotten rid of Emmeline. Like, every time a woman becomes a problem, he just disposes of her.
That's terrifying.
It is. But now he was without a secretary. He needed another typist. Poor, poor Dr. Holmes.
I mean, self-perpetuated problem there, sir.
Yeah. The parents of these missing women were hounding him for information on their children's whereabouts. The creditors were no longer being tricked by his charms and were pounding on his door for money. In March, his prayers were answered. A young woman by the name of Minnie R. Williams moved to Chicago and became his new secretary. But wait, Minnie was no stranger to Holmes. Back in 1889, the two had enjoyed each other's company for several months during his visits to Boston. They had wined and dined, he took her to plays and concerts, he bought her flowers, books, and sweets. She was infatuated with him.
He has already love-bombed her.
Yup. Now, Minnie did not look like the other women that Holmes had employed and seduced. She was shorter, quote, plump, and had dark hair. She had what was described in the book as a heavier brow line, a masculine nose, and, quote, virtually no neck. She was very nice, but not one of these, like, stark beauties that Holmes regularly pursued, mm-hmm. according to the descriptions in the book. No, Holmes had discovered back in 1889 that Minnie possessed something else he dearly wanted. An inheritance.
Oh.
Her family was very wealthy and owned a large piece of land in Fort Worth, Texas. Now, back when they were dating in Boston in 1889, Holmes had gone by the name Henry Gordon while traveling as a salesman. Minnie had always called him Harry and had been devastated when he simply stopped showing up. Like, his letters stopped, his visits stopped, and she was like, yeah, she was heartbroken.
She got left in the dark.
She knew that he resided in Chicago, and she knew that she was still in love with him. When she moved to Chicago, she contacted Henry Gordon at once. Holmes hired her and instructed her to refer to him as Henry Howard Holmes or Dr. Holmes. He told her the alias was for business purposes.
Of course.
Before long, they were together again, much like before. Holmes promised her a marriage, a voyage to Europe, art lessons, a big fancy house, and of course, children. He loved children. But there was something they must take care of first, he said.
Okay.
Holmes then convinced this woman to sign over the deed to her dead uncle's land, this mass of land in Fort Worth, Texas. Like, a significant acreage.
Okay.
She signs it over to a man named Alexander Bond, an alias for Holmes, and he then in turn signed it over to another man, Benton T. Lyman, an alias for Pettazel. He also opened a company, purely for fraudulent purposes.
Of course, to refer, as one does.
Yeah, to refer back to basically whenever somebody started to get on his case or call him about it. He titled it the Campbell Yates Manufacturing Company, and they literally bought nothing, sold nothing, produced nothing. It was just, like, on paper as a business that he could use for whatever purpose.
Wow.
It was signed into business with five officers listed as follows. H.H. Holmes, M.R. Williams, A.S. Yates, Hiram S. Campbell, and Henry Owens. Almost all of these are fake names, except for M.R. Williams, which was, of course, Minnie, and Henry Owens, who was a porter employed by Holmes. Holmes was using his preferred alias of Holmes, and Campbell was the fictitious man who supposedly owned the murder castle in Chicago.
Oh.
Yates was a man who was supposedly living in New York, but never actually existed.
Wow.
Yeah. So, Minnie had been telling her sister Anna all about her move to Chicago, the fabulous Dr. Holmes, the hotel, her new job as a typist, and of course, her upcoming wedding. Anna was a school teacher back in Texas and had grown suspicious of Holmes.
Well, as every people
time,
would.
Every time someone gets suspicious of him, I'm like, yes, trust that instinct. Go with that.
Follow your heart.
Yeah.
Or your gut.
In an effort to ease her worries, Holmes put the idea into Minnie's head that she should invite her sister to come and see the World's Fair, and better yet, stay at the hotel in Chicago while she visited her sister. Minnie was overjoyed by the idea and told Anna at once. When the school year ended in the summer, Anna would travel to see Minnie and the World's Fair, and Dr. Holmes and his hotel. In May...
Don't do it as a trap.
Don't do it.
Run.
Baby, come back.
You about to go in a trap.
In May of 1893, the World's Fair Exposition opened in Chicago. The architecture, the beautiful natural landscaping, the impossibly tall structures, and the calm blue lakes. It was breathtaking. Like, people began to pour in from all around the world to view the wonders that Burnham and his team had wrought. Fun fact, this also included the invention and world premiere of the Ferris wheel, named for its creator, George Washington Gale Ferris Jr.
There it is.
And also, they did several tests, and several people died in their tests on this very, very large, very, very tall wheel. And they were trying to put as many as 2,000 people on the Ferris wheel at once when they first started.
That's terrifying.
Yeah.
That's also a shining example of why I'm terrified of Ferris wheels. Also, low-key, I'm pretty sure I've been on the biggest Ferris wheel in the world, if I'm not mistaken. Huh. I might be. It, not like Ferris wheel where you're sitting in the little rickety death bench, though.
Mm-hmm. But, like, one of those enclosed ones?
Yes, you're, like, in a bubble.
Yeah.
We went on the big one in London.
Very cool.
It was very neat.
So, yeah. This... I don't know. It never occurred to me that it was named Ferris after the guy that invented it, and that this was the first time anything of this kind had ever been seen. Like, people loved it. People would go on it, like, over and over and over again, because you could see the whole city, mm-hmm. and, more importantly, the entire World's Fair, and, like... People were getting married at the top, and, like, people
That's
were...
still a thing that happens. I went to high school with a girl who got married at the top of a Ferris wheel at the state fair.
Cool. I guess the city didn't actually want to approve weddings up there because it was, like, really slowing down the process of, like, getting people through the line and stuff like that. But there were still a couple of priests who would, like, go up in the cart with people and be like, and you, I do, okay, go.
Kiss across my lap, this is very awkward.
Yeah. In an effort to pull in more business, Holmes changed the name of his hotel to the World's Fair Hotel.
Of course.
And he put signs all around in the streets, advertising near the fair for his business.
Rebrand.
Yeah. Like I said, you gotta hand it to him, he is smart.
Crafty.
As potential guests came by who wanted to stay in the hotel, Holmes used his own special brand of discernment to decide who he'd allow to rent a room. That is, anytime a young man or a family came asking, he would turn them away, saying that regretfully, he had no vacancies available and simply couldn't take them. Instead, he waited for single young women, pretty and vulnerable, to inquire at the counter, and then lo and behold, he would have room for them.
Magic.
He also moved himself and Minnie out of the hotel to an apartment on the north side owned by Mr. Oker. Soon enough, guests began to disappear from the hotel. A young stenographer, and then the waitress from the restaurant, a woman traveling from out of state, even a few young men, one of them a doctor and friend to Holmes, had gone missing. Friends and families wrote letters inquiring about their disappearance, and Holmes ignored them all.
Shocker.
Hotel guests noticed that the place had an odd smell about it. At times it would have a heavy caustic scent, and other times the smell of chemicals permeated the hotel.
Yike.
Many people simply chalked it up to the pungent odor of Chicago itself, and as for the chemicals, they reasoned that, well, there was a pharmacy downstairs, and the young doctor had to keep his supply well stocked.
I mean, I've never walked into a pharmacy and been like, wow, it smells pungent and caustic here.
Yeah, and like, pharmacies in the 1880s, granted, I don't know, but like, how do you just smell that and be like, ah, that's probably nothing?
It's just the pharmacy, it's fine.
What?
I mean, was this out around the same time that people who made hats were going crazy?
Probably. So, in the middle of June in 1893, I wrote 1983 and then I confused myself.
1985.
Anna Williams, or Nanny, to her sister, arrived in Chicago. She and Minnie perused the fair every day for 2 weeks, which was barely enough to see all that the vast exposition offered. They ate food, they enjoyed the displays, they rode the Ferris wheel. It was exhilarating and exhausting. Now, at the end of the 2 weeks, they were like, okay, that's enough. We've seen it all, like, we're good. Holmes promised them one more visit to the fair on the night of July 4th for the fireworks show.
The last visit to anything.
Like, if this man's be promising you something...
He's over here like, I got 2 tickets to You're Gonna Die.
Yeah. If he be promising you something, just leave. Just be like, you know what? Actually, I gotta shampoo my lawn on that day. I can't.
I have to take a phone call.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
I'm actually gonna be very, very busy shaving the hair on my big toe that day.
Correct.
Can't make it. So the show was spectacular. Fireworks rose into the sky and exploded magnificently with the backdrop of the fair and the Ferris wheel behind them. The whole thing was suffused with red, white, and blue sparkles while an orchestra played patriotic music for the crowd. People cheered and cried and oohed and awed. The finale? I don't know if this is accurate or not. I don't know if they could really do this in the 1800s.
I'm excited.
Was a multi-rocket explosion that, once it was in the sky, resembled a portrait of George Washington?
Sounds fake.
Sounds fake.
Like, even nowadays, I'm like, meh.
They're like, that was supposed to be the Pepsi logo, and I'm like, but
fake news.
It was kind of, it looked sort of like the Pepsi logo. You know what I mean? Like, fireworks, fireworks are amazing. Like, they can do crazy stuff.
But getting more extravagant than, like, a heart or a star.
Especially, like 1800s? I don't know, man. After the spectacle, Holmes sweetened the night with an unbelievable deal for Minnie and Anna.
Because it was probably unbelievable.
Seriously. He was taking them on a trip, he announced.
Don't let this man take you anywhere. Okay.
He announced...
To Europe.
He would first take them to Maine, and then New York, and then on to Europe to see France and Germany and Italy. He told Anna that she was really very talented and that she should pursue the study of art there. He was going to get her art lessons. Anna wrote home that night overjoyed, telling her family to write letters to an address in Chicago where they would be forwarded to her while she was traveling. She left all her belongings in a trunk still waiting in Texas, so her belongings hadn't even gotten to Chicago yet at this point. But she told her family that her new brother-in-law would take care of her and that her and Minnie were basically, like, set for life. They were ecstatic. She couldn't wait to leave.
That's so dirty.
Meanwhile, Holmes invited Anna to the hotel for a tour.
Shocker. You want to see this cool soundproof room I have?
Seriously?
No, no, sir, I do
nope,
not.
Nope, I'm good on that. That's going to be a hard pass for me.
I gotta go.
So, while they were going to the hotel, he asked Minnie to prepare their flat, since somebody would be renting it while they were away. So, you know, go pack everything up so that we can rent it to someone else while we're gone. So
while you're gone to die in.
To die, because you're never coming back.
Yep.
He and Anna went to the hotel, and they toured the downstairs retail spaces, the second floor apartments, and finally the floor of darkly lit hallways and hotel rooms. They finished in Holmes's office where they sat and chatted. He claimed he had some small business to attend to before their trip, and he settled down with some papers at his desk. He asked Anna to go into the vault and grab a pile of documents that he'd left sitting in there. Would you just go in there and grab those documents for me?
Mm-mm. Nope.
As she got up and walked towards the vault, he followed silently behind her and shut the door after she had gone in.
No, no.
It was pitch black in
the
vault.
Oh, that's so scary.
Anna began to scream and pound on the door, scared by the utter blackness of it. At first, she thought the door had just closed by accident and she just wanted out. Like, she just thought it shut behind her by some weird accident. Holmes went to his chair by the window and sat calmly, waiting. As time went on, the air grew stale and the vault began to get warm. Anna felt sweat on her face and arms. She screamed and screamed, pounding with all her might. She thought maybe Holmes had gone to another room and couldn't hear her, or maybe had no idea that she was trapped. Sitting outside with his ear against the wall, Holmes turned on the gas pipe that led to the vault.
What the fuck?
He filled the room with gas as her cries slowly subsided and eventually ceased.
No.
What the fuck?
He gassed her for a piece of land.
Without missing a beat. Holmes swept by the apartment to pick up Minnie, saying that Anna was already waiting for them at the hotel. They had packed up the entire apartment and were on their way. A little while later, he called Ochre to let them know that he would no longer be renting the apartment. The Ochres were shocked, but when they went upstairs to see, the apartment was indeed empty, hastily packed up with just a few items here and there left behind.
Mm-hmm.
Several weeks later, a large trunk full of clothes arrived for Nanny Williams, but was never claimed. Holmes had it shipped around to various addresses and then made a donation to his friends, Ben Pitazel and Pat Quinlan. To Pitazel, he donated many fine women's dresses and shoes for his wife, Carrie, and their three daughters. To Quinlan, he donated two very fine, sturdy trunks engraved with the initials MRW. Both men and their families were very grateful for these gifts.
They knew he was killing people.
Yeah.
They put their child in a murder dress.
Yeah. Oh, and that's the other thing. I didn't put this in my notes, but since you brought it up, Holmes said to Pitazel's wife, like, maybe you could, like, cut up these dresses and, like, sew them into smaller dresses for the kids, you know, since these are all women's dresses and, like, you need dresses for the kids. You need clothes for the kids. And you're really good at sewing. You're a great seamstress. So, like, you could just use this fine material and make your own dresses. And she was like, yeah, that's a good idea. So the clothes wouldn't be immediately recognizable as Anna's.
What the fuck?
Bruh.
I hate it.
Yep. 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 And that's where we're gonna stop for part two. Thank you again for listening, and part three is coming soon, I promise. Remember, you can check out anytime you like. But you can never leave the fucking murder castle.
Moida.
Toodaloo.
Okay, bye.